This podcast is brought to you via my favorite platform, Skype. So, a very good day. Welcome to the podcast.
Where am I?
Okay, so our weather down here is grey, overcast and autumnal today, which contrasts somewhat with the picture that we're going to look at next, which is a very special development of the car, as we welcome Ricky T to the podcast. So Ricky T, a very good day. Welcome to you. How are you? What's your weather like, by the way?
Hi Vince, yeah, the weather here is absolutely perfect in the Basque Country. I think it's about 25 degrees, clear blue sky and no wind, so it's perfect.
Lovely. Okay, well I can tell you by the way that you are responsible for me waking up, not in a cold sweat, but certainly with things on my mind, because you've given me this weird bit of information that today we'll be looking at. Which is to be part of making history, and it's all about a supercar. Now, I woke up, and I will tell you why it sort of jolted me up when I was thinking about this morning. But let's talk about this supercar. What is it, and how far away is it from fruition?
Okay, yeah, it's a company called Aero Mobile. And they're going to bring out two models, a two-seater and a four-seater. It's a car, and it's a flying car. So, yeah, it's obviously going to be a historic moment when they come out. And they're basically high-end vehicles, which equally work on the road or in the sky. So, obviously, it's called a flying car. So, yeah, you can seamlessly transform from a car to an aircraft, from going from driving to flying in under 3 minutes.
Okay, so what happens? Do all the wings sort of fold up under the plane and make it sort of just exactly like a car, but with either something on the roof or something below it? Is that the idea?
Yeah, basically. So... yeah, it's obviously it's a very unique product. You know, it's going to be launched very, very shortly. You know, I haven't got the exact date of when it's going to be launched, but it's just like a normal car. The wings fold in, and then when you want to fly, they just go out, and yeah, you can fly like you're flying a plane, basically.
Okay, now, for our listeners, if you're thinking that we're talking in the realms of fantasy, there's a website which is Aeromobile, A-E-R-O-M-I-O-B-I-L, and they're talking about the pedigree, including top car makers BMW, Aston Martin, McLaren, Mercedes-Benz F1 and Ferrari F1, and then the aerospace leaders Lockheed Martin, Rolls-Royce, Airbus and Diamond Aircraft, amongst others. So, personally, I think this would be the worst possible thing that could happen. And basically, the reason why I think that is because you only have to look at the state of the roads. You only have to look at the state of the terrorists that use cars now in ways that people would never really have used them in the past. You know, you're looking at the speed that they are claiming they can cruise at, 160 miles an hour, for example, just cruising, and takeoff and landing, you know, they're saying verified by actual flight test, 400 meters, 300 meters, 1300 feet roughly. So you can transform between driving and flight modes in less than 3 minutes. So does that really give you time for all the safety checks necessary? Because I seem to remember that if you're sitting on a plane and you're on the runway, they seem to do safety checks for the best part of a couple of hours before you can board, checking the flight, you know, as it comes in. And then you taxi down the runway and, you know, 3 minutes. I don't think so. Not for safety. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's undergone over 350,000 hours of groundbreaking engineering and design. You know, they've had over, I think it's 10,000 hours of simulated and live flight tests over the course of its development. So, you know, I think this is the new technology. It's ready to go. Obviously, it's a lot smaller than a normal plane. So yeah, maybe it's time for this to happen, and you'll see them flying around, you know, in the next 10 years or so.
Well, you know, every now and again you look up and you hear this droning sound and you see sort of a one-seater biplane, or not a biplane, it's more like a little hover thing, isn't it? You know, that you see them going over. And at the time they came out, I must be honest, I thought, thinking back about this, I don't really seem to realise many... I don't see many of them around at the moment. I don't think I can see... I can't remember seeing the last time one of those things, but there was a little spate of them. So, do you ever see them?
No. Obviously, I think it's a different concept. This is a lot more advanced. It's more like a plane and a lot more robust. So... yeah, I think this is like the next step to this this kind of direction, and this time they're more like proper aeroplanes, you know, like private jets mainly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the website and I see that, as you'd expect, America is the protagonist, or at least on this particular one, and the map shows me Tampa and Orlando, sort of areas that I suppose you would expect Florida to be in the mix somewhere. But really, do you really expect it to be sort of just people flying around in cars before too long?
Well, it's actually a European initiative from Slovenia, I think. Yes, it's from Slovenia, and it's funded by the European Regional Development Fund, and they've chosen obviously the states because they're probably more open to these type of ideas. I think, you know, like if the whole Agenda 2030 goes ahead, and you know, maybe there's less people on the planet, there'll be room for these type of vehicles for sure.
Okay, let me just read what they're putting here. When an auto awesome exhibit rolls into a world-class museum, and it happens to include several iconic vehicles seen in a number of James Bond films, you can count on 007 fans to be both stirred and shaken. Because when author Ian Fleming's famous fictional spy is nearby, or at least some of the dream machines he's driven, over-the-top action, super cool devices, and can that be real inventions seem to naturally follow. So it really, what they're saying is exactly what my fear would be. If you look at the James Bond film, all you ever get is people blowing things up and doing things that really are not what we would say authentically good behaviour. So, I mean, I can only see this not being a good thing, because quite frankly, if you look at the roads and you look at the speed that young people, especially here in Spain, we have carnage on the roads. And yes, of course, if a really cracking car goes by, I love to see them. I mean, where we are down in Denia, they do have some beautiful cars, absolutely wonderful. But you really have to have your number plate visible, and sort of people will know where you are coming and going in a general sense. So if what you're saying here is to be totally and utterly believed, then, you know, I can imagine sort of small scale cars, you know, like private jets. But for general consumption, I can't see this happening. I think there's too many dangers, too many things that would, you know, the wrong hands would get hold of these very quickly.
Yeah, I think it just depends if it's managed correctly, and you know, there's a limited amount in the sky, and you know who's flying them. Obviously, it's not for the average person. You know, it's for the elite. So I don't think anyone could just afford this type of car anyway. And if they put a limit to the amount in the sky, you know, like you see in all the films, flying cars, futuristic cars, well, you know, they're in the films, I think, for a reason, because that's the plan for the future. You know, they may even consume less as well. I'm not sure how much consumption it would be, but flying would probably be more environmentally friendly, maybe.
Well, I don't know. You only have to look at the way they've tried to cut back on the jets and make sure that they're not flying to see that really, you know, there's more pollution up there in the atmosphere. And if you're going to put cars up there as well, it's going to be immediate rather than having to rise from the planet's surface up into the, you know, the various parts of the atmosphere. No, I don't like the sound of this, because basically, you know, drugs are smuggled across land in fast cars, brought in over sea by fast boats. And I would imagine this is just another avenue for people to bring drugs in. That's the way I feel about it. It's totally unnecessary. But I won't be able to stop it, and so therefore I'm just giving you my opinion. But that's what I think.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly. You know, it's happening. Companies are out there designing these type of products. So, yeah, you know, you can't really stop it. It's going to happen, whether you like it or not.
Okay, right. So let's get to the second part of what we're going to look at today. Let me just put a little bit of music on while I check my papers. Okay, so when we make this podcast, we are looking at weird information, because obviously there's a lot of weird people doing lots of weird things. But this is about things to do, well, with all sorts of parts of life, but it's facts about life you won't believe you didn't know already. So obviously, when you sent me the link, I went to have a quick look, and the first one is quite interesting. So tell us what we shouldn't be doing when it comes to our medication.
Okay, yeah. So I think in Spain, it doesn't really affect the Spanish people, because Spanish people don't have cotton in their medication, apparently. All the Spanish people I've been dealing with have told me this. But obviously from in the UK or the US, you always get cotton in your medication bottles, and I didn't know this, but you should throw it away straight away.
Okay, so any particular reasons why? I mean, I would imagine, well, I don't know really, why did we have it? Because we did have cotton wool in these little bottles of medicines, or, you know, pills. So what would be the reason for it?
Yeah, I've lost your sound there, Vince. I can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
I can hear you very faint.
Okay, right. No, that's because I was...
As if you stepped down a hole all of a sudden.
Ah, okay. Well, I've come back. You should be okay now. Can you hear me okay?
No, still. It seems like you're like in a distant room.
Well, I am in a distant room.
Well, yeah, you are.
Okay, well, look, it's coming out on my podcast as being okay. So,
okay.
So we were looking at the cotton wool in the top of the medicine bottle, which we did have in Britain. I do remember that happening, and I don't think I've seen it in Spain. So the reason for this is?
Well, basically, it just collects moisture because of its absorbent nature, and they'll make your pills deteriorate faster.
Okay, I certainly hadn't heard that one before. So let's go to the next one, which is it's easy to calculate a tip without a calculator.
Okay, well, you know, obviously in the UK, we don't really tip that often. But obviously in America, it's standard. So you know, say if you want to tip 20% for good service, the quickest way is just to move the decimal point one digit to the left and then double that number. It's that easy.
Okay. And it's great that the Americans have to be told that, because quite frankly, if you're going to give 20%, it's about the easiest thing that you can possibly work out for yourself. So that's typical American nonsense for me. Okay. So next you're going to tell us about people and how tall we are during the day.
Well, you're the tallest first thing in the morning. So this phenomenon is maybe due to gravity, they're saying, compressing the cartilage in our spine and other parts of our body, such as our knees, and when we stand up or sit down throughout the day. While you're lying down in a resting position, the spine is said to spread out or decompress, which makes sense. So then we wake in the morning, we're taller after lying in bed and not all night.
Okay, and this comes to us from the Jamaica Hospital Medical Center. Now, I don't know about you, I stretch my spine on one of these balls that you can lie over and stretch. And I like to hang, if I can, at some time during the day. So that's another little piece that I think both of us would have been aware of. But certainly, that's something that I do. Do you do that still?
Yeah, well, I try to hang whenever possible, upside down as well. I've got a special gadget which, you lie on and you go upside down. And I was told about that many years ago. And whenever I get a bad back, that's what I use.
Okay. No, I agree with you, because quite frankly, it does appear to me that if we have a spine, and then if you look at the way people curve, especially if you don't walk properly, if people want to reference this, there's a technique which is the Alexander technique. It's on the internet if you want to find it, and basically it'll tell you why you should walk with your head held high. And in actual fact, there was a lesson, a class that girls used to be given in England called deportment. And it showed them how they had to walk. And they used to practice walking with books on their head. And you also have been a little bit of a protagonist of this as well, haven't you?
Yeah, well, you know, in Wing Chun, you know, this is a martial art, Chinese martial art. You know, if the structure is incorrect, it breaks down everything. It breaks down, you know, every angle of your defense or attack. So just by moving one part of your body and it's out of line, it's a bit like a building. You know, if the building's if there's a few bricks just not in the right place, it can turn into the leaning tower of the Tower of Pisa, or it can just fall down.
Yeah.
Gravity is very strong.
Yeah. Okay. The thing that I think most people should be aware, especially when they're looking on the internet, is that our grandparents and our forebearers, they actually had some very, very well thought out and well understood principles to most of their lives. So a lot of the stuff that is being presented around the internet as new ideas, some of these are as old as the hills. But let's have a look next at why you should sleep with your door closed.
Yeah, okay, well, obviously this is really for fire, but it'll protect you from smoke and toxic fumes. Obviously a lot of people unfortunately have died in fires, you know, the fire brigade have always said that, you know, the toxic fumes have been the culprit. So yeah, if you close the door, it might help you in that instance to at least wake up and be able to escape.
Yeah. You see, conversely, you could say, well, okay, close the door, but keep your window open. But then I can remember one particular day when we were waking up on a Saturday morning and inhaling beautiful smell of pine. And then we realised that there was a pine fire, which ended up with 14,000 of us being evacuated from our town. So, really, I mean, you've got to really adapt your sleep patterns to what is best for you, because it's all very well saying keep everything closed, but I mean, I always remember being told about fresh air. Then, of course, you get conflicting evidence and information from people telling us that, you know, we've all got toxicity in the air and that it's probably not as healthy as it used to be. What can you do? I mean, here in this part of Spain, you every now and again get a bit of a ticklish, you know, you think you're going to start a cold, and then you realise that there's been some rain during the night, and in the rain is sand which is coming over from the Sahara. So it really then, you know, it makes everything look really dirty, and you have to clean everything to try and just get back to normal. So I don't know. I mean, by all means, some of this information is interesting, but is it always accurate? I think you have to look at your circumstances and take any bits of information that we give as something that you can consider, and don't take it as gospel. I think you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's just, you know, obviously all these articles, it depends who wrote them. You know, it depends. You've got to find out basically the background of the person, of who the author is, and then and work from there as well, because, you know, a lot of these websites, you can't just use it as gospel, and yeah, you know, you have to verify the sources basically.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, as we are getting more and more dubious information, and people are being reliant on Google and things like this, you've got to check everything thoroughly. So we're looking at some information from the Commonwealth University next about sleeping in a cold room. So what's this about?
Yeah, basically, you know, they're just saying just with a month of sleeping in a 66 degree room has helped increase subjects' fat burning ability by as much as 10%. You know, I follow a guy called Wim Hof, and I every morning I try to have a cold shower, followed by his breathing techniques, and the cold shower definitely improves the start of my day. So I think cold is kind of like your friend, really. We've been educated to think that cold is our enemy, but if you think about our past, you know, when we used to live in caves, we didn't have heated caves. You know, like, it would have been a fire maybe, but not, you know, everywhere would have been heated. So maybe we're meant to be, you know, obviously not freezing cold to the point of death, but we should be in a cold environment a lot of the time.
Well, I suppose the logic would be also, if you are cold, then some of your body functions would try and work to heat you up a bit. And so if that's the case, yes, I could understand that you could lose a little bit of weight, if you like. But again, you know, just use it as a guide. We're going to yawning next, which, again, is a weird thing because, you know, we all yawn and stretch, especially in the morning. So what they've given us an approximate number, haven't they, of yawns over a lifetime?
Yeah, well, I think it's probably going to be true, you know, around about 250,000 times you yawn. This is according to an expert on the subject, so I don't know anyone who's an expert about yawning, but that's a strange one. But yeah, if you do the maths, if you live to 70, you know, and you do, you know, on average around about 10 yawns a day, I could understand that, you know. Probably 10 yawns a day is probably a good amount of yawns.
I know that sometimes when you yawn, you can almost feel that your jaw has unclipped at the back of your mouth. And, you know, sometimes you've got to be very careful about things like excessive yawning, because some people, you know, they don't realise that can unhitch and can give you a problem. Okay, and so next we're looking at breathing and swallowing.
Okay, so I suppose it makes sense, you know, but yeah, you can't breathe and swallow simultaneously. So, you know, the reason why is because the food and the fluids we swallow and the air we breathe in both travel down the same part of our throat. So, yeah, you know, maybe some people don't realize, and it's not really something you would want to be doing anyway, but it's good to know.
Okay, and that was a registered psychiatric nurse that had to tell us that one, whereas I think most people, by default, you probably will have worked that out for yourself. Now, one thing that is always a little bit dodgy is somebody who is giving you a phony smile. I hate somebody that gives you that kind of a smile. And, you know, it's used very often in films. You can see that a smile can be a warm thing and it can be a genuine thing, whereas there can, of course, be such a thing as a fake smile. You know, people who are nice to your face, but they really don't mean you any particular good. So what information are they giving on this one?
Well, there was a study in 2011 published by the Academy of Management Journal, and the researchers looked at the behaviours of bus drivers. Obviously, it's a profession where people are required to have many friendly interactions throughout the day, and they discovered that these people withdraw from their work while putting on a smile for show, and that could have long-term effects on health. So I kind of disagree with that, because I think most people like doing their jobs, and I don't know how many fake smiles you can give a day. You know, you can give a fake smile maybe to one person, maybe, if they've done something bad to you, but it's hard to give a fake smile repeatedly to people unless you really hate your job and you're just there for a short period.
Well, quite honestly, I think these type of bits of information, these types of research are very, very spurious. I mean, as long as they use the conditional tense and, you know, don't say for sure, they cover themselves, anything can have a long-term deleterious health effect. But, I mean, if the bus driver was grinning his head off or her head off, rather than looking at the road, I would prefer somebody who wasn't particularly communicating a wide grin, but was getting us safely from A to B, as opposed to somebody who was grinning like a jackass and crashing his bus in the process. So that one, I find that rather strange. Okay, tell us about babies and kneecaps next.
Okay, well, I don't know if you've ever considered this, but babies actually don't have kneecaps, you know, when they're born.
Yeah, I think I did know that, by the way.
Sorry?
I think I knew that.
Yeah, well, they say that they do, but it's just that they're not made of bone. The little bits of cartilage that have yet to ossify into bone.
Well,
so yeah.
That doesn't surprise me, because I was watching the cage fighting last night with Conor McGregor, and he was fighting this Russian guy, and he kept getting himself into really difficult situations, which, of course, I could relate to from my judo career. And, you know, when you see the positions a baby can take up with their little legs, it certainly is something that, you know, if you could do that when you're a lot older, when you're fighting on the ground, you'd have a bit of an advantage, wouldn't you?
Yeah. No, it's definitely a killer on your knees when you're doing judo or any kind of martial arts.
Yeah.
You know, I've had problems with that.
Yeah. Okay, so tell us, what is Eigengrau? I'll spell it Eigengrau. I think I've pronounced it right, but I'm going to say Eigengrau. What is it?
Well, you know, when you see pitch darkness, obviously you have a colour. It's I thought it was just black, but that's the name of the colour. When there's pitch darkness.
Okay, and from what we're reading, it's looking as if it's the shade of dark grey people see when there's no light. Okay, yeah. I'm just closing my eyes as we're talking. It looks pretty black to me. If you do the same, what colour do you see?
I think it's like a blacky grey colour I see.
All right, I'll go for black. See, yeah. You know, I suppose, you know, these scientists, they've got to justify what they do. But, I mean, sometimes you think, well, is that worthy of study? I don't know. Okay, so what's this about smell and rain?
Well, they have a name as well, you know, like... you know, it's the smell after it rains has a name, and it's called I think it was petrichor.
Let's spell that. P-E-T-R-I-C-H-O-R.
Yeah, petrichor. So it comes from an oil plant's exude that dries on the ground. When it rains, the oil combines with a byproduct from a type of bacteria to produce the smell.
Okay, well, there is a smell after rain, so I can understand this one. You know, if you go out into the garden or you're near plants after rain, there is a smell, but it smells nice and fresh. You know, it makes you feel that everything's just been cleaned. So I didn't think of it as it coming from oil. So, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Next time it rains, I'll go out and have a look at that.
Oil from plants makes sense. Yeah.
Okay, well, the next one we're looking at is looking at craving, because I remember as a child when, you know, when you had certain illnesses, you would crave things. And we're told that when ladies are pregnant, you know, they get cravings for certain things. So I've never craved ice, I've got to say. But what are they telling us about that?
Well, there's obviously, if you like crunching ice after you finish your drink, then you might be suffering from anemia. Okay. So this is actually from the Mayo Clinic, which is quite a reputable place. They say it's also known as pagophagia. And it's the compulsive eating of ice. It may not just be a nervous tick, but a way of cooling inflammation in the mouth caused by a lack of iron. So yeah, you know, it's a lack of iron, they reckon.
That's quite interesting, because I do know that certain people do crunch on their ice cubes. It's not something that's ever been part of my remit. Let me just quickly give us a little bit of a break and tell people what we're doing.
Okay.
We're looking at some weird facts, some things that you might never have even heard. Okay, so we're talking next about knives. Now, there's one thing I hate is to see these guys who go around the restaurants selling sets of knives. You know, with all the street crime and with all the violence on the TV, I just think it's totally unnecessary. So, what have you got for me on knives?
Well, you know, yeah, basically sharp knives aren't actually as likely to cut you as dull ones. So, you know, it's kind of it's an eye-opener for me because I used to be a bit kind of wary of sharp knives. But they say that, you know, obviously sharp knives easily slice through food. So you only have to apply a small amount of pressure when using them. So this means that you're more likely to cut the item you're intending to cut and not your hand. So, yeah, that's a good point, because every time I have cut myself, it's because the knife hasn't cut as easily as I want it to cut. So I forced it. And then I slipped and I cut myself.
Okay. So that's actually quite a good one. That's the best one I think we've had so far. Yeah. Okay. Now, the next one is, it doesn't really apply to us, but I mean, you probably all have heard of the skunk. And the skunk has this habit of, once it feels threatened, lifting its tail and squirting you, which apparently is called skunking you. I didn't know that. But there is a way of maybe counteracting the foul smell in liquid, isn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, as always, you know, they seem to be the same ingredients come up all the time. You know, you've got dish soap, peroxide, and the best one is baking soda. So baking soda, obviously, there's thousands of uses for baking soda. But the mixture of those three, it kind of fights off the smell.
Yeah.
Gets rid of the smell.
When they talk about dish soap, I would imagine the American language or the use of the English language doesn't really always tell us what we mean. Dish soap, I've never known dish soap. Are they talking about ordinary soap that comes in a spray and, you know, you just spray it into your hands? Are they talking about a bar of soap where you just lather it and then use that? They need to really to be a little bit more specific on that, because I've never heard of dish soap written like that. Have you?
I understand dish soap as the, you know, the like the old bars of soap. You know, the blocks of soap.
Okay. So that
that's how I understand it.
Okay. All right. Now then, we'll go next to Wikipedia. Now, Wikipedia is like, it's a bit like Google, I suppose, really, in the respect that the minute you want to know something about a subject and certainly about people, then you go to Wikipedia. So what have you got for me on Wikipedia?
Yeah, it's just a fact that probably most people don't know, but, you know, it is actually downloadable. So you can keep it all on a USB drive and you download it directly and you've got it there for you to use.
Okay, I can see it being something good for maybe a library or something, but I think for the average person, would you want to download it?
No, it wouldn't be my, but yeah, you know, it's just really, it's just good to know that like most things on the internet, you know, you can do so much of them and most people don't know this, a bit like a mobile phone, you know, people probably use about 5% of what a mobile phone can do or a computer can do. It can do so much more, but, you know, we don't use that technology.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, it's giving you the fact that it can act as your tour guide. Well, of course you can, because basically you would use anything like that if you want it to just develop knowledge of a certain area of the planet or whatever. So let's go to more life forms on your body than people on Earth.
Yeah, this is, well, it's a bit disgusting, but it's good to know that, you know, apparently you've got trillions of them which inhabit your body. So in fact, 90% of the cells in your body are actually composed of microbes.
Yeah, I think
so. It's teeming. You're basically a planet teeming with microbes.
Yeah, well, we can just develop that and say that you know, your face is crawling with little spider-like things, aren't they?
Exactly, exactly. So it makes you wonder, you know, it's just you know, what our purpose on the planet is. You know, maybe we're their vehicle, we're their body, so they can live their lives.
Yeah, you could well be right. Yeah, I mean, very often you feel your face is itchy, don't you? You know that it's irritated, and you don't see anything. So this is according to the BBC, and they could put everything under the microscope, and they'd see lots of things that we can't see, which, you know, apparently water mustn't get rid of then.
Apparently what, sorry?
Water. You know, when you wash your face with water, you would half expect that to get rid of the problem, but obviously it doesn't.
No. I mean, you know, that's why obviously I'm a surfer, so spending time in the water, I think it's a good thing, because you're like given all these minerals, and you know, obviously if the water's fresh. But people who don't wash their faces or don't have the opportunity, and they're, you know, God, they must have trillions of them, you know, on their face every day.
Okay, well, we look next at something which a scientist is going to tell us. This is a scientist at Oxford, and he's looking at the size of a person's orbitomedial prefrontal cortex. Okay, what is that, by the way?
Well, it's part of a brain that identifies other people's moods and personalities. So it can even predict the size of that person's social circle.
Okay, so I'm looking at the average prefrontal cortex, averages out to around 147.8 friends in a social network. Be honest with you, I think this is garbage. I really do. I you know, I honestly think that is one of the most ridiculous pieces of information that a scientist from Oxford could ever come up with. You know, that you look at the size of somebody's whatever it is, and then decide how many friends they've got. If they were to sort of maybe investigate whether that part of your body is attractive to other people, then I might start thinking that might be a bit more useful. But I think to sort of just come up with a little statement like that is just a little bit silly. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I kind of agree. But at the same time, one, the scientist has probably received thousands in funding for this.
Yes. Okay?
But two, these type of things can lead onto interesting things. So, for example, the new technologies, like on the mobile phones, there's all these apps which you know, can convert your face into other things, and people use them thinking that they're free apps, and it's really funny. But what those apps are doing, they're collecting data of everyone's faces. So there may be a way now or in the future where this orbomedial prefrontal cortex could be linked in to this, to the stats. And yeah, you know, even when you kind of like want to study a country or a company or regions, you know, they may be measuring that part of your face as well. and it may lead to other answers for maybe, you know, obviously it's people's moods or people's behaviours.
Yeah, okay, but we're using the same coulds and cans all the time. You know, these things, I think, quite frankly, I think in a decade or so, I think people will see through this nonsense with the phone. I mean, you know, you can only get so much pleasure out of a piece of equipment. If you go back through your own life, you'll find that when you were X amount of years, you liked this particular thing and you spent a lot of time doing it. And then, you know, when you come to another part of your life, you think, what on earth was I doing wasting all my life with that particular piece of equipment or game or whatever? And I think that, you know, you can't beat just going out and meeting people. Now, this could be in line with our next piece of information.
Okay. Yeah, people with friends, you know, are meant to live longer.
Okay, so this is Michigan State University. So again, you know, as you'd expect, it's American stuff. Whenever there's this type of stuff around, you can always rely on the Americans to be trying to find something, which they should really know is common sense. If you've got an active social network and you've got close friends, you've got more reason for going out to see people, haven't you? I mean, if you're going to think that Facebook is the answer to having no friends, well, Billy No Mates, believe me, one person putting their finger and pressing down that they like you is not the same as somebody who bothers to come out of the way to come and see you. Okay, what would you say? You're obviously younger, so you're going to see life maybe differently to me. But I feel that there's a lot of nonsense to do with likes. Even the marketing, I think these people are a little bit blinded to the fact that if you just put your hand and press, that doesn't mean to say you'd go out your way to buy. What do you think?
Yeah, no, it's completely false. And, you know, I personally don't like, you know, the social media. And there's a film on Netflix about social media with all the ex-employees involved in the company. And it's a very eye-opening documentary because, you know, their goal is nothing to do with likes or just having the company. It's something completely different. You know, it's controlling society.
You're absolutely right. That is so absolutely right. You know, I sort of was always slower to get into some of these technological platforms because basically I was thinking to myself, well, this doesn't really make sense. I mean, when you base your marketing solely on how many clicks people put on their computer, now there's a whole lot of difference. I mean, we don't even know who the person is at the other end of the click. That's how silly it is. You know, it can be somebody purporting to be a lot older or purporting to be a lot younger or not even the same gender. So there's...
Well, not that. Generally, it's just a bot.
Yeah, but I mean from the other end, from our side of the computer or whatever it might be, you know, we are often just, you know, if somebody has looked at something and it goes, you know, 25 likes, you've no idea really who those 25 people are. It could be a husband saying to the wife, go on, love, you just look at my Facebook for me, I haven't got the time. Or the other way around, the wife might be the busy one, she says to her husband, you know, I've no time doing it. And we do know this happens anyway. You know, we know of people who don't use the social media, but we do know that they have a page on Facebook and somebody runs it for them, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, but there's another industry there of, you know, you can buy Facebook likes and buy Facebook comments.
Yeah.
And many people spend thousands on that. So all their comments and likes are just from bots anyway. So it doesn't really, you know, you never know.
Well, I always relate to the fact that when all this started, for me to learn about the internet. I've never had a class of anything to do with using computers and technology. I mean, really, I've sat and educated myself as much as I could as when things were necessary. And I always remember there was a lady that you will know who ran a language school, and she used to say, I never understand how it is you can always come up at number one in the rankings where, you know, we spend lots of money and we don't always come at number one. And I used to say to her, it's because I used to spend a lot of time. I mean, you only do one of two things. You either do it yourself and you don't pay, or you don't do it yourself and rely on others to just get you the results. So there we are. Okay, the next one I can relate to, and it's to do with your hair growth and ethnicity. So what have you got for us on that one?
Well, you know, it says that human hair generally grows at a rate of 6 inches per year. Okay, I think my hair grows faster than that, but there is difference in growth rates based on ethnicity, which makes sense, I suppose. You know, so people of Asian descent tend to have faster growing hair than those of other ethnic backgrounds. So, yeah, I mean, I've been to China and to Indonesia, and you don't see many bald people there.
Would you say, would you say that could also be to do with the diet?
Yeah, it could be. It could be the diet. It could be, you know, if you look out on a deeper level, you know, it always fascinates me how people, these ethnic minorities, can change so radically, and they're basically in the same territory, because you know, you can drive to China if you want to from Europe. And as you cross the borders, you have people who change, you know, so differently. They look so different. That's another deeper question to ask, because where do those people really come from? You know, I don't believe there's like an imaginary borderline on the planet where all of a sudden, you know, people become Asian. It's almost as if they've come from different parts of different planets, even, I would dare to say, you know. So they're bringing in different characteristics, you know, to the human race from different places.
Okay, we just got about another three of these, and then that will take us to our time. But it's funny you say that, actually. Look, I'll tell you, the other night I was looking at a series on Netflix which is looking at the standing stones, the menhirs, the dolmen, the likes of Stonehenge in Salisbury in the UK, the likes of Carnac in France, the menhirs in Brittany that we've seen. And then it showed you the other side of the world where you had the Inca empires and, you know, all these wonderful villages that they are reckoning now were about 8,000 years before Christ. I mean, that really is mind-blowing information. Should what they're doing as they're measuring be true? I mean, it's absolutely amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's there's so much, I think, that we don't know, and it's just those imaginary borders. All of a sudden, people become Asian. It's hard to get my head around that part, and obviously, you know, different types of human beings, you know, how different we all are.
Okay, we move to the last couple then. Young adults are more likely to be living with their parents than on their own. Well, I think we can work that one out, and the reasons that they give us, what do they tell us about that one?
Yeah, well, as always, if you don't have the cash for rent or a down payment, you know, obviously a down payment is a lot, you know, you're not alone. So, you know, for the first time in over 130 years, you know, more people in Spain, this happens a lot, you know, between 18 and 34, they live with their parents, than on their own or with a partner, just because they can't afford it. That makes sense. I think with what's happening now, it's going to get worse.
Yeah, I think also it's the way that some parents bring the children up. Some people are happy to dominate the children and, keep them young. I mean, here in Spain, as you did identify, it's not unusual to see men of, say, 30 out shopping with the mothers. There's no way that I had ever did that with my mum. Mind you, we didn't have supermarkets when I was growing up. I mean, that's the sad fact of how life has changed. You know, we didn't have such a thing as a supermarket when I was a young lad. But there we are. This is an interesting one and it's important. So if anybody has not heard this one, tell us what people should know about the aspirin.
Yeah, well, apparently, if you're unlucky enough to have a heart attack, if you take an aspirin, you know, during the heart attack, it may save your life.
Yes, I have heard about that, and apparently, it's best to keep. Doesn't say here, but it's probably best to keep it underneath the tongue, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the drug inhibits the platelets from forming a clot that can block an artery. And cause a full-on heart attack. So for the fastest relief, and the time is of essence here, obviously chew the aspirin instead of swallowing it.
Mm. Okay, no, they're not easy to chew, are they? So I suppose it's like, from what I think I read initially about this, you try and crunch it down and then keep it under your tongue, But that is worth knowing because, quite frankly, I think a lot of people maybe that can be a lifesaver. Tell us about spell checkers and spreadsheets next.
Yeah, well, obviously, if you work with spreadsheets, before you hand off that important spreadsheet, you should always be sure to run a spell check manually to spare yourself any undue embarrassment because there are no spell checks on the spreadsheets.
Okay. I think better advice is learn how to spell because unfortunately too many teachers these days, they don't do what I had to do, which is basically I had to learn how to spell. And we had teachers that checked us and we had daily tests and all things like that. So that's where I think a lot of this comes from. I do think that people didn't learn to spell properly after it became less fashionable to spell. Okay, so yeah. Our last one then is very rare, but it has been known to happen, and it's called coffin birth. I hadn't heard of this, but tell us what it's all about.
Yeah, obviously it's not a very nice thing, but you've got to know this information, but women can give birth after they die. So it's a phenomenon that occurs when a pregnant woman delivers a child spontaneously after her death. This is due to the gases that build up in the abdominal area, putting pressure on the mother's uterus and forcing the baby out the birth passageway. Mm. So an example was discovered in 2010. In the grave of a medieval woman who was buried in Italy. That was according to Smithsonian.
Yeah, okay, so this is very, very weird. And of course, one thing that quickly crossed my mind was the speed at which Princess Diana was actually embalmed. Which led to many people beginning to wonder what really did happen and why it happened. So, yeah, interesting that one. Okay, well, yeah. Ricky T, we've covered a couple of interesting things there, which, of course, in particular, gives me a little cause for concern with these cars that can become aeroplanes. But would you buy one?
No, I'd probably hire one, or I'd if they become like taxi service, Uber services, I'd probably use it for that reason, but I wouldn't have it personally. No.
Okay, well, as ever, my thanks for joining me on our quest to find some weird information, and for our listeners, let's hope you enjoyed today's version of Weird Information with Ricky T. My thanks, Ricky.
Bye bye. See you next time. Bye bye.
This podcast is brought to you via my favorite platform, Skype.